Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn, and you're very welcome to A Taste of Ireland. My guest this evening is John Healy, maitre d' on the TV show The Restaurant, and general manager of Susie Street. John, lovely to see you.
Nice to be here. Thank you very much.
John, I was looking at your bio there earlier, and I must say, I was boggle-eyed. I'm so impressed. You've done an amazing amount of stuff in your life up to date. And I noticed that you were a bit like me. When you were growing up in Naas, John, you were a bit mad as well. I saw there that you were used to cycle around the place like a madman.
We had no iPhones or technology then, so you knew where everybody played by where the bikes ended up in the road. And we were in a very young estate in Naas, up in Woodlands near the racecourse. So all my friends lived next door or down the road, and we all used to cycle around the town together. It was very safe then. You know what I mean? That was way back in the 70s. And, God, we're that old. And, you know, we used to cycle to and from school. And one day, I ran out in the road on the bicycle without looking, and I was hit by a car. I was eight or nine years old. Ended up in Crumlin Hospital with a fractured femur. I'll never forget it. It was those kind of experiences mould you, you know what I mean, in your childhood.
I think growing up in Cork, I'm not sure my mother knew where I was half the time. You know, as long as you were in at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, and all those houses were being built then, so the housing estates were like playgrounds, and all the old houses were adventure sites for us, you know, and all the kids around. It was great fun.
Where, John, did your love of food, I suppose, or your love of the hospitality business originate from?
I have no idea, but I do remember I kind of fell into the business, you know what I mean? I mean, Mum was a great cook, and she used to entertain a lot at home, and she used to do sort of like whole salmon cooked and sort of dressed on a dining room table, and we'd have like 20 people in the house for parties and that kind of stuff, and she used to put that together very well. She was a great cook, and she still is a great cook, and I suppose that influenced me an awful lot. But I kind of was looking for a summer job when I was, I think it was fifth year or sixth year, in school, and looking for a summer job. And I walked to town from one side of the town, every premises, and back down the other side of Naas, and I couldn't find a job. And I met a friend of mine. I was disheartened, completely downtrodden, a 15, 16 year old, and probably working illegally as well, because I was probably underage, and who knows. But she said, go up to the townhouse there, and they're looking for lounge waiters, right? And I was like, what the hell is a lounge waiter? I went up and I spoke to the man, and I was a very polite young fella. I really was kind of very well behaved. I was a little bit cheeky, but I had a nice little personality on me. I know now. And I made a fortune. I made an absolute fortune serving drinks on trays to tables. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
And that was the Lord Bagnall Inn in Loughlin's Bridge. That was another.
Yeah, there's a story behind that, because I wanted to go to catering college, and my mum was going, you're not going into that business. She knew exactly what it was like, and that the hours were very long and unsociable, and that it was very hard to make money. And, you know, she had a fair understanding of it. So she sent me down to the Lord Bagnall Inn, because we knew somebody who owned the Lord Bagnall Inn in Loughlin Bridge. And actually, James Keogh still owns the Lord Bagnall Inn in Loughlin Bridge. And she sent me down there to get it, and got me a job for the summer. And I was working maybe 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and having the time of my life, and learnt bar trade and food service down there with them, and loved it, and loved being around people, and loved having the crack, and loved everything that was social about it.
And that led to on to a course you did in hotel management and business studies in, of course, the very famous Cahill Brewer Street,
very
College
famous,
of Catering.
Yeah, and I didn't get in on the first call, and I remember I rang the administrator, Brendan Keyes, God for help him, I don't know where he is now, but I rang him every second day pleading with him to let me in. Where was I on the list? What number was I on the wait list? How far more had I got to go? And I think he got so sick of me ringing. I think he got so sick of me ringing him, because I had his direct number, that he just said, start Monday. And I remember starting on Monday, and they were already started. So I was about 3 or 4 weeks behind. walking into the class. Very nerve-wracking experience for a young fella, yeah.
Yeah, well, you see what they say, John, a winner never quits and a quitter never wins. So you started early.
Fighting my way in, yeah.
And then, interesting, John, you had a spell, of course. I mean, just talking about went on from there.
Yeah.
You moved then to London. I mean, you had a spell in Paris at one stage within the firm Irlandais.
Yeah, my French was so bad that actually the lecturers in Carlbrew Street, you know, I have to go abroad, and you really should go abroad. I mean, people should go abroad and experience, especially in this business, because you broaden your mind and you broaden your service experience, and you get to find out what people are really like. Because when you go outside Ireland, people are very different. We are so fortunate that we are the way we are here. When you go to London or you go to Paris or New York, you get to see what people are really like. So I went to Toronto for the first year in college. My uncle had a place over there and I was working with him, and it was great to go and see Toronto. This is like when nobody traveled that much, really. And then the second year I went to Paris, and not many people know this, but Myrtle Allen from Ballymaloe had a restaurant. Do you remember this? La Ferme Irlandaise in Paris.
I heard all about it. Of course, Myrtle, one of the founders of the kind of Blue Book.
Yeah. She had a restaurant in Paris in the 80s, and we worked there. Three of us from college worked there for a placement. I washed dishes, and we worked there for the summer, and they had an apartment that we lived with them in the apartment with the staff of the restaurant. Let me tell you, we had a ball.
Well, I mean, John, you've done everything. You were a luggage porter, a room service waiter, you've washed pots and pans, you're saying, and you've mastered the French language doing all that.
I had a morning job that started at 8 a.m. in a Résidence du Bois, which was a Relais Chateau hotel, very, very nice, up behind the Arc de Triomphe, and between Arc de Triomphe and Avenue Foch. Very posh hotel. Nobody spoke English in the hotel except for the manager, and she was on the front desk. And I had to do everything. I had to literally to do everything. So it was luggage porter, room service. We changed rooms. Your basic job was a garçon d'étage, which was a chambermaid. And I learned all my French through working with the people in the hotel, of what a sheet was, what a pillow slip was, and general conversation of work. And then it expanded from there. It was exciting in one sense, but you learn so much so quickly. And when you're so young, you pick it up very quickly as well. And then and I had run across town in the evening, and we used to wash pots and pans in La Ferme Irlandaise, and we'd finish work at about midnight or 11 o'clock, go out to the nightclubs or whatever, the bars. And when you're young, you can do this. Yeah. And then have 3 hours sleep and go back to work again.
You moved then to London, of course.
Yeah. Kind of like I finished college here and got my degree, did my thesis, got a placement. I worked with the Ryan Hotel Group, ended up in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary. Ran Magnum's disco bars. You remember Magnum's disco bars? I didn't Dunleary.
No, I'm going to say no.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah. The one in the Gresham Hotel, and there was one out in Dunleary. I ran that for a while. I was night manager for a while, and I used to run weddings, like 5 weddings on a Saturday afternoon in the Royal Marine. It was hilarious, and I kind of gone as far as I can go at the age of 21, whatever it was, 22, and it's decided that I wanted to go to London. People were going to London at that time. There was a depression in the 80s, and people were moving, and everybody kept saying, go to London, it's great, and it's so exciting, and there's so much over there. And I went to London. Oh my God, I had nowhere to stay. The girl I had organized an accommodation with, the owner of the house looked at me straight in the eye and she says, you can't stay here. I was on the streets in London for about 4 weeks. I was going from sofa to sofa. A lot of my college friends were there, so we had no mobile phone, so you had to go into a pay phone and ring people and arrange to meet them. And if you missed them, you were on the streets for the night. It was that scary. I remember being in the airport in Heathrow like twice or three times because I missed the person I was supposed to meet. And there's no way of contacting them. So it was quite hard, and eventually we got, because it was expensive to try and get a place that time then, and you know, it wasn't really that scary, but it was, and London was kind of safer than it is now, so you could do that. And I remember going to the Bunch of Grapes on Brompton Road. I mean, a lot of people remember that pub because it was very Irish, and meeting a bunch of people there and asked them, could I stay in their house or on the sofa, and willing to pay for it. I had a job and I was going in and out of work with my suitcase.
There's a movie in this.
Yeah, it's a gentleman's club in Pall Mall. It was hilarious. And but eventually we got a place, and I remember sharing a room with somebody else to try and make sure we could manage to pay for it. And I had a job, and I got a job in the what was then the Hyatt Carlton Tower, which was my first 5-star hotel experience, which was mind blowing. We didn't have that kind of... I didn't know what a cappuccino was, because we didn't have them in Ireland in those days, back in the early 80s. This is 88, 89. And walking into the international sort of the Carlton Tower Hotel on Sloane Street, which was then... I mean, Sloane Street is still a very posh area. The Carlton Tower was mind-blowingly luxurious to me, you know, and the chandeliers and the thickness of the carpets and the way staff held themselves and the way they worked around a restaurant and the way they looked after people was alien to me completely. So I literally went from management back down to being a commie waiter.
And of course, John, the rib room there, you would have been rubbing shoulders with the local aristocracy and thespians and
everybody.
All sorts of bohemian types.
Famous people were just in and out the whole time. It was the norm. Like Fergie used to come in and out there before she got married.
Yeah.
You know, Tony Venables, the famous... football coach, he used to come in and out there every Saturday, and we would slag each other because I was Irish and he was English, and the football and all that. And Sean Connery used to come in and out of there, and Roger Moore was in and out of there. All those sort of, like, you know, old A-listers were in and out of there. And I met everybody. Like Michael Jackson stayed in the hotel when he was touring, and they took me to the concert from the restaurant because I looked after the management of the tour. We're down in the restaurant. And of course, Michael never came down.
Yeah. Wonderful, John. Listen, that brings us on very nicely to your first choice of music this evening.
This person's 75th birthday this week. One of my favourites of his is this track, Moondance.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance.
A Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant's adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn, and you're listening to A Taste of Ireland. You're very welcome back. My guest this evening is John Healy, maitre d', TV celebrity, general manager, luggage, you name it, John. What else? Pot washer, you have everything. Amazing career today.
Well, you have to do it all. Ed, you have to do it all to know what's going on. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And John, then you came back and you slummed it in the Four Seasons here for a few years.
Well, actually, when I came back, I ended up... I had a job, and then I ended up finishing with that job, and I ended up having a sort of like a sabbatical for about 4 months during the summer, which was great. But I then, when you go around to try and find something that you really want to do, now with the kind of like CV I had and the experience I had, there was nothing really at that time in Dublin that was kind of like, you know, I really wanted to get into. I met the guy, the opening of the Morrison happened that year, and my friend from college, Gerard Dennehy at the time, was a GM, and we went down there and we were at the opening party, all of us who knew each other, and they were like, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I think I might go back to London. I'm not quite sure. And then somebody suggested I went down and talked to him in the Four Seasons. Go down and talk to John in the Four Seasons and have a chat with him. You know, it's great to have a chat with somebody in the business to find out where you're going and to reflect on what you're actually doing and where you really want to be. And, you know, you have to bounce things off somebody who knows what's going on. So I went down and I spoke to John, and I didn't really want the job, or we didn't go down to get the job, but he kind of convinced me to do the opening for him to settle. You know, and to do the opening for him and open the restaurant, which I did, and I run it, which I ended up doing for 8 years. I just took off in that hotel, and it was phenomenal.
You were the face of the Four Seasons. I remember. I mean, it was a fabulous time there in that hotel.
It was a Celtic Tiger. There was a lot of money around. A lot of people with a lot of money. Everybody needs to be recognised, and I'm very good at that because I learned the old school way in the Carlton Tower. So, you know, everybody needs to be recognised. I needed to know who everybody was. I remember one of my best friends sitting in the who knew everybody in Dublin. I didn't know everybody in Dublin. I used to sit her in the bar, and I'd be running in and out to her. Who's that? Who's that? Who's that? Who's that? Who's that? Who's that? And I would memorize everything. And I would look at all the magazines and all the social magazines and figure out, oh, that's the chairman of so-and-so and that's the chairman of so-and-so, and remember that stuff and bring it in and show it to the guys on the floor. So I'd know who everybody was as they were coming in. As they became regulars, I would know their names and I would call them by their names.
Incredible.
And it was work. It was what I did. Mm. You know what I mean?
Because you worked in corporate management consultancy. I mean, you told people about personal image, people skills, social ethics. I mean, listening to you there, I mean, you sound to me like you could write the Bible on it all.
It's kind of stuff that, you know, a lot of what we do in the business is common sense. Mm. A lot of what I pick up is common sense. A lot of what I kind of like, even customer service training, I've learned from what I know, from what I've picked up, running those restaurants and teaching staff how to interact with people. Eye contact is very important. So when you're talking to somebody, that you look them straight in the face, that you're not looking on the floor, you're not picking your nose, or, you know, your hands are not in your pocket, all that kind of body language stuff you actually react to, and people react to you when you react to them.
Very interesting, John. You were obviously living, I suppose what people would say is quite the high life a little bit there.
Yeah.
And then you completely renovatio.
You know, working in the Four Seasons was, and working in Mezzo in London, and, you know, what you were giving, what I was giving to my job. You could say I was addicted to what I did, because I was there constantly. Breakfast, lunch and dinner most days. I worked kind of 6 days a week mostly, doing kind of like 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And you were always on your feet and you were always moving. And it was very high octane, very high stress. When you're charging that kind of money in those hotels, there is no room for error. And that's my pressure. Yeah. You know, making sure that things worked on time, making sure that the kitchen worked on time. We used to do an average like 200 or 300 meals out of that kitchen every Friday and Saturday night. Because
No pressure.
You had the restaurant, you had the cafe, you had room service, you had the lounge. There was constantly food going in and out. Constantly people who were paying a lot of money. Mm. You know, it was averagely, at that time there was a lot of money. It was like 100 euros a head for dinner. So you know, you have to, when you're charging that much money, you have to give that kind of service, you know. Four Seasons did change the service in this country completely. Mm. Turned it on its head.
You needed a break. So yeah. Portugal beckoned the villa.
Well, you know what happened? Well, you didn't remember what happened to me. I keeled over in, it would have been 2007. I had a heart attack.
Yeah.
I went back to work and I stayed in a hotel until 2008, where I felt the whole thing closing in on me. So I actually left. I started working for myself a little bit, but I ended up having a second heart attack in 2009. You know, I went back smoking, actually, is what happened, really. I just keeled over. And it was a kind of time where, you know, what happened in my life was I had to stop, literally. I went on a transplant list, and the year I went on a transplant list, I had to get out of the country. I had to go and take care of myself. And I ended up looking after a guest house in Portugal. And it was a very kind of calm guest house. It was a very kind of like recovery place, as opposed to somewhere where you go down and party. And I ran that for the whole year. It was the May that we had the volcano in Iceland. And I stayed down there for the whole year. And I was held together by medication. And I used to fly home to go and see my cardiologist and the heart failure clinic at Dunleary. And then in November, I came back and went back and did the TV show. The restaurant.
You're famous for that. I mean, you were saying over 20. How many years, John, was it?
20. We started, the first show went out in 2002.
Such a success story. Mm. I mean, and people just they love it.
I didn't want to do it. I mean, I was asked, would I like to be on a TV show? And I said, the last thing you need me to do is a TV show. Plus, if I didn't want to be portrayed as this mad queen running around a restaurant with a clipboard and a lisp, you know, on TV, there was enough of them running around. And it was kind of like more of a professional attitude I had towards what I did, as opposed to taking the piss out of it, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But they convinced me to do a screen test for it. He told me my personality was perfect and that I look good on camera. I'm still not quite sure about that. And I did the pilot for him. That was 2002. And we're actually going to go in and do production on the 20, is it? Oh God, I can't remember how many years I think it's year 17.
The restaurant is addictive because anything that pits people like that, and you know the wrath of those judges.
Well,
you know,
especially when you get to see. Rachel. Well, first of all, you get to see a celebrity as a normal person, you know. So you get to really see them properly, and it was great. Some of them we had in there. It was great to see them and doing what they did, and, you know, making fun of the whole thing, and, you know, there was some great characters on there, as well as that food show. So people like food, because because it was normal people cooking normal food. And then, of course, we were critiquing everything that they did. So it's fun.
Yeah, I've seen some. Yeah. I've seen Simon Delaney and a few of them that, you know, I think there's definitely MasterChef material in a lot of them.
Absolutely. It's amazing the amount of people that cooked very well. Simon Delaney being one, and he's gone on to do other stuff now.
And John, just going back, I suppose, it must have been very difficult when the diagnosis had been the heart disease.
Yeah.
You know?
People say, oh, what was it like? And I'm like, it really was the most fantastic experience I could ever experience. I gave myself the opportunity and I gave myself the space to go through this properly. I got the help I needed. I remember when news broke that I was actually waiting for a heart transplant, I was being interviewed constantly by papers, magazines and newspapers. And I ended up stopping all that because as I was doing it, I was revealing part of myself that I didn't even know was there. And I was going into sort of like my own personal sort of like, therapy. Doing my own therapy out loud. So I stopped it and I got a very good therapist. I started making the TV documentary that we did because I could tell a story. And the guys from the production company VIP who do the restaurant show, they made it with me. The director of the documentary was Anna Nolan, and she'd worked with us on the restaurant before. And Mark, who was also one of the series producers on the restaurant, was living with me at the time anyway. So we kind of made that documentary. And as I was doing the documentary, I was being interviewed by Anna. And plus on the flip side of that, I was also beginning to write a book.
Yes, a perfect wonderful read.
Yeah, about my life. And it was just for me, it was very cathartic, the whole experience for me, because there was issues I had to go through. There was stuff I had to deal with that I hadn't dealt with. There was a lot of deep, meaningful, you know, work being done by me. And I had a fantastic counsellor who took me through the whole process. So I remember after a year of doing all of this and constantly writing all this and making all of this, that she turned to me and she said to me, "You're ready for your new heart now." She actually said that to me, and I was like, "Oh, okay. Now I'm ready. That's going to happen." I felt amazing because I'd done all this work. And, you know, I always say 7 weeks, you can invest in 7 weeks is fantastic, because everybody needs some psychotherapy or some therapy to help you figure out who you really are and where you're going and what you're thinking. You know, you walk around the city and you see people who need help.
Yeah.
You know, psychologically need help. And especially during this pandemic, we all need help.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's no harm to put up your hand and go, "I need help."
Yeah.
That's exactly what I did. And it was phenomenal. The experience was just phenomenal. What I got out of it was amazing. Amazing.
In your industry as well, we've covered it over the past few weeks. You know, the quintessential chefs throwing cleavers around the kitchen. And as you said, cooking 200 covers a night, and, you know, chefs with like bad diets. And but the mental health thing has become, and so thank God important. In Ireland, we have really kind of got to grips with it. But people have really realized, and I think you've been great stalwart for this as well, the importance of how important it is to look after your mental health.
Absolutely. I did a degree in counseling and psychotherapy. Through all this as well, and I now help my own staff, anybody, and I can see problems in people, and you can see their issues, and you know what they are, and you can put, everybody knows everybody's like, "Oh, that one there, oh, he drinks too much," or "That one there, oh my God, don't put him in the middle of a nightclub," you know, this kind of stuff. So, and I sit with them and I go, "Okay, so what are you doing, and what's going on with you, and how do you behave socially, and, you know, how do you think you're being perceived by your colleagues, or who do you perceive to be somebody you want to work with, or who do you emulate, or who do you role model," and that kind of stuff, and help them to figure out who they really are. These kids have sometimes nobody, no families, and they're away from home, you know, they need somebody to look up to, and need somebody to help them through life. Yeah. I remember when I was in London, and this is a very short ditty. I was in London and I had this 20-year-old Italian guy who spoke very little English. And he ended up, cut a long story short, very short, he ended up in my office, in my arms, crying his eyes out. And for some reason, I got out of him eventually. He was just homesick.
Yeah.
The guy needed to go home to his mammy.
And Italians, I think, John, I know a lot of them, they feel it a lot more, and they love the mammy.
They're so
Italian. Like ourselves.
And I actually just booked a flight on my own credit card there and then, and said, "You're going home tomorrow morning to your mother. And then come back to me when you're ready." You know what I mean? And you have to take care of people like that when you have a position of responsibility. That's my responsibility, not only to my customers, but also to my team and my staff. And I feel that, I mean, you know, and that's why you build a team, that's how you keep them together. you know, is by looking after them properly.
It's wonderful to hear that. That's like actually a perfect heart story. Really, yeah. The caring there is amazing.
And it's only what I've learned, Ed. It's only what I've picked up for myself, what I needed for myself, I give to them.
Yeah, you know? You learn to experience.
Absolutely. It.
Wonderful, John. That takes us on nicely to your next piece of music, John, which is a singer that I've loved for many years as well. Can you tell us about this wonderful lady?
It's Annie Lennox, and she had two or three amazing albums in the 90s. I remember the tourist, that group she was in the early 80s when I was in school, and she did her own solo album. So this is one of my most favourite tracks of hers.
A taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn, and you're listening to A Taste of Ireland. And I'm joined this evening by my wonderful guest, John Healy, who I've introduced already as basically the jack of all trades in terms of from Four Seasons to pot washing, John. You've done it all. You're
done it all.
Amazing.
Absolutely.
And a heart transplant in between all
that. Just threw that in there for good measure. Absolutely, yeah.
It's a fascinating journey, John. And I suppose... Now living with a new heart, how is your life these days?
It was generally a phenomenal experience, and you kind of go through it mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And I got myself ready because I had to grieve for my old heart, and I had dreams about this, and accept this new heart into my body. This other person's heart I was getting, and just when you sit and think about it, it was quite a massive experience. The first years after, I was elevated to this kind of like spiritual sixth sense of existence, and I knew I was going to be okay. The medication was great, and everything I did was fantastic. And, you know, the hospitals and the nurses and all this, you know, all that kind of background stuff that they looked after you was phenomenal. Okay. And possibly because as well, I did all the work. I'd done the psychotherapy on myself, and I got some help and all that kind of stuff. I felt like a new person. I really did. Now, do you pick up the traits of the heart that you have the donors? You don't. It's all about the medication, because you're on so much steroids, so much high level medication, that a lot of that can affect you in the way you think and the way you feel and the way you believe and stuff like that. But after a couple of months, you come down to a normal pattern and a normal level. And I really do still appreciate life on a daily basis. You know, the second lease of life is something that not all of us can get. And I feel very honored and blessed to have got this new lease of life. And the novelty hasn't worn off yet. You know, I did have a kind of a company that I ended up doing outdoor catering. I ended up doing the markets in and around town. I ended up working on Electric Picnic and all the festivals. And it was just a freedom of being alive, I suppose. I did that. That's very hard work, though.
Sounds exhausting.
I remember doing one weekend, a friend of mine and myself, had an Airstream down in Electric Picnic, and we served 5,500 burgers on one weekend. I eventually got to a point where I wanted to go back to my proper job. I spent 3 years doing yoga avidly, like three or four times a week, and I loved it. And that helped me a lot as well, to help me be grounded and open and honest with your life. I eventually needed more money because, they don't pay very well. So I ended up going back and getting a job. And Susie Street is where I fell into. I went in to help them out first for 6 months. And that was now 5 years ago.
You know, amazing. And I must say, we're talking about lockdown. You sent me your supper club.
We did a takeaway or a delivery service.
Yeah, the listeners, this isn't your normal delivery now. This isn't one of the other that just arrived. It was a tiny bit of work involved, but you actually feel that you actually kind of almost cook it yourself. Yeah. But this beautiful box arrived with this instructions, and it literally took me 20 minutes. But the food, I mean, you're talking about, it was seriously delicious restaurant food. Everyone had to change and adapt.
Every restaurant, I think, in Dublin needed some to generate some kind of revenue. And in my experience, fine dining food or high-end food does not travel. The reason why Thai, Indian, or Chinese food travel is because they're wet. Okay, you cook them in a wok, or you cook them at a restaurant. You put them into a box, and they travel, and you can actually reheat them, so they're fine. They're wet; they won't dry out. And there's no sort of like a intricate preparation. We had to deconstruct a menu and put it into a box, and make sure that you get the restaurant experience at home, and that you get that restaurant food experience at home. And that was my objective. Even trying to do a piece of fish, if you cook it beforehand and send it out, or a piece of beef, you cook it beforehand and send it out, it's gonna taste like rubbish by the time you get it. So there had to be a little bit of constructive preparation going into it. So we deconstructed each dish, and we put it together in such a way that when you got it at home, you could assemble it yourself and maybe heat something or cook something yourself. And that was the only way it was going to work. Everything was vat packed, and everything was packed in little kind of envelopes or little boxes, so that you got instructions of how to put each dish together. Some restaurants were doing videos or Instagram videos. Dylan McGrath did a whole YouTube experience for his dishes, and you know, and some of them got really quite into it. I wanted to keep it as simple as possible, and I wanted to keep it as good as possible. So we did a Chateaubriand was our most popular dish, or a beef Wellington, whereby you got the stuff ready to go. It was actually seared and marinated by the chef, and all you did was turn your oven on and put it in for maybe 40 minutes, and it was done.
Now, what's wonderful, I was in recently for a little celebration as well in Susie Street, and I was pleasantly surprised. I was expecting to be going in a hazmat suit and to be surrounded by plastic shutters and plastic walls. And, you know, it was nice that I was, you know,
drama queen.
Yeah, I know. It was lovely because I was, you know, I mean, that's one thing I think I find very difficult about this current situation. You know, you can't greet people or hug them or kiss them or whatever.
Yeah.
But,
We're huggers. Yeah,
but it was wonderful. So I was pleasantly surprised by that, actually. And I suppose, I mean, the landscape has changed, John, hasn't it?
So much, yeah. And it's going to remain changed for a long time. We're not going to get back to normal for another, at least a year before things really come back to normal again. And until the vaccine becomes out, people are not going to feel safe. So we have to kind of coexist with the virus as the way it is. We have to make our businesses work. We have to give people the confidence to be able to come into a place. And that was my objective when we reopened Susie Street, was to give people the confidence to come in and help them feel safe in the restaurant. So we took a lot of stuff out. And we're very lucky in the restaurant that we have three different areas that I can take a few tables out. The social distancing is fine, and it's not empty. You're not in this cavernous sort of noisy vacuum kind of place. It actually does a nice little buzz in the place, and there's a good atmosphere. And we have an outdoor area as well, a terrace that the roof closes when it gets too cold, and we can heat it, or it can remain open and you're outside. So the feedback we've got from most of our regular customers who live kind of like Rathmines, Ranelagh, Rathgar, Leeson Street, Ballsbridge, Donnybrook kind of area, are most of our regulars in that caption area. They've told us that they feel safe. They told us that it's lovely. Our reviews on TripAdvisor and on Open Table tell us what we're doing right and tell us what we're doing wrong. That's why feedback is so important. You know, our social media is very important as well, so you let people know what's going on, where you can go, how you book it. We're doing a supper club on Open Table in September, whereby you can come in for dinner, three course dinner with a bottle of wine for 100 euros for a couple.
Brilliant.
And it's a nice experience, you know. So it's give people the sort of confidence to come back out again, to come back into society. Businesses need us. We need businesses need people to make money, to be able to survive. I'm trying to hold jobs for about 10 people at the moment. It's proven to be quite difficult. You know, the wage subsidy scheme has changed this month, and it's going to be very much more difficult than it was. We've lost a lot of large parties. All our corporate bookings are gone. Our weddings are now reduced to a maximum of 50 people. We used to do 100. So it's, you know, it becomes now harder to make your business viable, to make a profit. Our rent is huge, and they won't negotiate. So we're paying, what is it, 20 grand a month rent and rates, around that sometimes. So it's kind of like, you know, we need people to look after the restaurant industry. Everybody knows how much we're banging our heads with the government, trying to get them to reduce VAT rates, trying to get them to do, you know, constructive commercial grants for restaurants to be able to survive, and pubs, and they're getting hammered at the moment. You know, really are getting hammered at the moment.
John, I suppose coming on to questions that all people that work in your business hate, right?
Yeah.
But always people are always interested to know. I mean, you've really I mean, there's nothing that you haven't touched on yourself over the years in terms yeah. of your experience. These days, I mean, you'd imagine everything would be sort of, you know, fairly good, but you still can get terrible bads. What are your pet hates when it comes to service?
I hate bad service. And service is all about personality. Why are you hiring somebody, putting them on the floor because you need a body in a uniform? Hire a personality and teach them the skills. And that's what I do. If you have the correct attitude and the correct personality, you can do anything. Okay? And I hate bad service. I hear somebody being rude to me. You know, we're paying money, and this is what I teach my own staff. They're paying good money to get looked after by you. And this is why people come out for the experience. You know, create the experience. And I hate bad food. There's no reason for bad food.
No, you know? You'd imagine.
Yeah, in this day and age, it's just either chefs being lazy and not training their staff properly, or the person who's looking after the lunch or the dinner on that day just not putting it together.
What about a guilty pleasure? I mean, what would you have?
Oh, I'm a sucker for a good fried chicken.
Mm.
And it's actually, you know, we're blessed at the moment because there's a good few little new nooks and crannies around, little small places that are doing good fried chicken and a good dirty toasted sandwich.
Yeah.
Can't beat it. I love it.
Fantastic.
I love them. You live on them.
Where would your favourite restaurant be? That's like people asking you, what's your favourite child, isn't it?
Yeah. Asking your mother, what's your favourite child? I have a few little places around where I live that I can walk to, and that I've always done good food, and they look after me. They put me in a corner. And it's kind of nice to be able to go there and feel comfortable. And that's why I go to somewhere. So when I know the guys and I know the chefs who own it, the food is very good, I will go there. I don't really like those Michelin star fancy restaurants. I find them very stagey, and I find myself being on stage, and I do that every night. So I tend to, only on a special occasion will I go to something like that. The fact that everybody knows me in the business is kind of like, sometimes
they're terrified when you walk in.
There's a little bit of that going on, which is kind of embarrassing for me. So I tend to, you know, stick to my little locals. I have a little restaurant down around the corner in Beggar's Bush, where I live in Grand Canal. So, and they always look after me. And there's a few friends of mine that run little places around, like the Old Spot and Juniors and the Chop House. And there's a few others down there.
Nice.
That are nice little, you know, no fuss, no mess, good food. And I can go in and have a couple of, you know, a glass of wine or whatever and then go home. It's
brilliant.
Great. Yeah.
And finally, John, Concannon or Coddle?
God. Kilcannon. Yeah.
I thought you might say that.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Well, I'm from Kilkenny originally, but my parents are Kilkenny, so it's like we used to do that down there.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. John, listen, it's been a pleasure to talk to you this evening.
And you, Ed, and you.
Can I ask you just to tell us a little bit about Roisin Murphy Incapable, your final choice of music?
I came across Roisin Murphy at Electric Picnic. And I thought, oh my God, who is this person? Who is this person singing? Where's that music coming from? Well, I can't hear. Where is it? I had to go off and find it. And I thought of all the music, the new stuff. There's a lot of new music in Ireland, and a lot of new artists coming out in Ireland, like Picture This and, you know, Codaline and all those guys. Roisin Murphy, to me, is so exciting, so cool. And I adore what she does. So that's why I chose that, because she was the newest Irish thing that I felt I fancied. You know, music wise.
Brilliant. But John, thank you for being a wonderful guest this evening.
My pleasure.
Pleasure talking to you.
Lovely talking to you too. Thank you very much.
It's gone cold. It's horrible.